type of transmission. K2RW, K2J. To my knowledge, Europe, which is on a different system, they're not using 8VSB. I forget what the name of their system is. FDM. Anyhow, orthogonal FDM, I think it is. They do have a distributed transmission system. In other words, a bunch of cell sites, so to speak, are doing their television broadcast. I think you're saying the United States is in metro areas considering doing that. Where is that planning? In other words, have they already purchased the hardware and about to install it in Times Square, so to speak? And are there major metro areas that are about to start doing this? Over to you, Eric.
Currently, right now, at 4 Times Square, there is a bunch of secondary transmitters that, that have a temporary SDA to actually do some experiments with. And who is it that has it? I think it's Univision. I'm not absolutely sure which station it is, but there is a distributed transmission process going on in New York. It's not up and running yet. It should be pretty soon. There will be auxiliary transmitters put at various different places around town. Actually, CBS has contracted us to, since I have a Channel 22 antenna that's still available, they were considering using the Channel 22 and a low power transmitter to supplement their reception. But there is a Channel 23 in Smithtown, which for some reason some people seem to think that that's a no-no. So they didn't file with the FCC, but the reality of digital television allows you to run adjacent channel without any problem. So if you wait a little while, I can give you some more specific information on what's going on in New York.
Did you say Channel 33 in Smithtown and CBS from New York is also on 33? Did I hear you correctly on that one, Eric?
Negative. I said Channel 23. And since I have antenna space with an antenna that'll work on 22, so that would mean there would be three DTVs right next to each other, 21, 22, and 23. I also looked in terms of who's on a 22, and it's well outside the range that the FCC would accept. So, you know, it's an actual possibility. I don't know whether that idea is dead or not, but, you know, I'm not directly involved in it, so I couldn't say.
If I understand correctly, WFTY, Digital Television, which claims to be channel 67.1, is on digital channel 23. And for a while, you used to be on 22, therefore your 22 antenna probably works pretty well on 23. Am I correct on that guess, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, the concept was because, you know, CBS on 33 and NBC on 28 right now have their issues and will continue to have their issues because they are, in essence, transmitting inter-symbol distortion between the main antenna and the backfill antenna, by the way, which is pretty much ruins the South Shore of Long Island. It also creates a lot of other problems. They don't have the problems going west. They don't have the problems going north. They have the problems going east and south. So the idea was to, since 22 is blank at the moment, to put up a temporary low-power 22 antenna in plain view, which would then expand their coverage and give people a way to pick up CBS without any issues, you know, as well as you could pick up Channel 21. And actually, it would also expand their grade B because they would be able to have a better reach out east. So that was the whole idea.
Interesting. Okay, we've kept John, WA2VDH, waiting an awful long time. We better go over to him. John, WA2VDH, what would you like to ask the TechNet? Hope we haven't put you to sleep with all this jazz. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, fine business. This is all a learning experience for me. It's great. My question is along a different line. It has to do with transmission lines and power transmission. Did a little rough calculation and worked out a wavelength at 60 cycles as being 3,000 miles, and a sixth of a wavelength, or 60 degrees, as 500 miles. My question is, first of all, I know that long-distance power transmission is done in a balanced three-phase arrangement with six conductors. I know that the center tap is grounded and run along the top of the towers as a lightning arrester. So I know that there are six conductors and that these are 60 degrees apart in phase, in a hexagonal, in a hex kind of arrangement. My first question is, after they've gone 500 miles, do they compensate for the amount of phase shift they picked up by just shifting the conductors around one notch? And my second question is, how do they pick compensate for over long distances for the variation in phase that's introduced by transmission line effects, the phase delay or phase shift that's introduced by the transmission line effects? Is it some kind of, I don't know, maybe rotating core transformer that they can compensate for that, or is that done at the generating site? Back to you, Dick.
Fantastic. Hey, John, those guys in Roosevelt, they don't let any grass grow into their feet. Wow. That's a beauty of a question. I've gone down this road myself. Now, I'm going to show you my variation of it. Assume now you've got a national grid, and assume that the grid connecting Michigan and New York are sharing power. There are times when Michigan has more generating capacity than load, and they're sending power to New York. And there are times when New York has more generating capacity than load, and they're sending power to Michigan. And in order to make it come out right, the power that comes from Michigan, when it arrives in New York, because of the laws of physics and time delay, let's say it has 60 degrees of phase delay. And when you add your generating capacity in New York to the power that's coming from Michigan, you must be in phase with them. Therefore, the way you synchronize your generator, your AC generator, if you the main shaft is rotating at some exact rate in order to make 60 hertz. But if you shift the phasing of that shaft rotation ahead or behind, you can adjust the phase angle of what comes out of the generator. I'm reasonably sure they're not doing it electronically, although pretty soon that will be a lot easier to do as we eventually go over to megavolt DC transmission, which Canada is already doing. Canada hydropower, Canadian hydro is being transmitted by high voltage DC, and there's some significant advantages for doing that. It doesn't run into the great big problem of the sunspot cycle and prominence coming out of the sun, creating DC voltage on the line, which drives the transformers crazy and burns them up, so to speak. And we've had those kind of failures. So there's some huge advantages of DC, and when you convert it back to AC electronically with the right computer program, you can do anything. But in the old-fashioned system, you have to adjust your phase accordingly depending on who is the source and who is the source and who is the load. And so I know where you're going on this one, and it's a tough one. And then what happens to the real phase angles and amplitudes of the system when a lightning strike occurs, a particular power line is overheated like it did during the blackout of, I guess it was around 2005, August 14, I think it was, 2005, we had a major blackout because of a overloaded power line in Ohio sagging, touching a tree, taking out that portion of the system. And while everybody is trying to rebalance, all kinds of craziness can take place. And so is our power distribution system, our power transmission and distribution system, is it stable? There's been some articles in the IEEE proceedings and IEEE spectrum on this very subject. Complicated stuff. I'm unhappy about the fact, let me drop, that they're trying to do everything on the fly. In other words, if there was a central planning facility of some kind, they should be able to say, okay, if this particular high voltage transmission cable in Ohio gets knocked out, we have to do this, this, and this to keep the system stable. may have to black out, brown out or black out a particular community in Ohio. And yes, that's bad. But it's nowhere near as bad as blocking out the whole darn east coast of the United States if you don't take the corrective, the proper corrective action at the right time. So each one of these potential failures, in my opinion, can be anticipated, and what is the least damaging corrective action could be planned ahead of time. This could all be set up in a computer program, and a computer program would say, aha, I recognize the signature of this particular kind of a failure. I go over to subprogram number 45, and I do all of these things. That should be done, in my opinion. To not do it is crazy. It is you're waiting for a disaster to happen, and it's like a man inside of a paper bag. He doesn't know where the next punch is coming from, so to speak. I don't think this should operate that way. One of the fun questions you can ask your fellow engineers, John, is that when you start connecting your particular generator to a grid, and you don't want to be drawing power from the grid, you want to be supplying power to the grid, do you advance the phase? Do you advance the voltage? You ask the question that way, and the majority of your fellow engineers will look at you kind of strange, saying, gee, I don't know. In reality, you get the phase just right, and you increase the amplitude, let's say a millivolt, and all of a sudden you're supplying power instead of sourcing power. However, as the amount of power that you supply increases, so that New York used to be the load for Michigan, and all of a sudden New York's got a whole lot of extra generating capacity, and they become the source for Michigan, as you increase the power, I think you have to slowly start advancing the phase to make everything come out right. That's my quick analysis of this. That's what I've seen so far, John. Fascinating question you're asking. WA2VDH to take it, with a little bit of delay in case we got some smart power people online. K2RIW and the TechNet listening.
I always heard that the way that once you're synchronized in, then you advance the phase to start sourcing power, to start feeding power into the grid. I've heard horror stories about generators that have synchronized out of phase where much smoke and fireworks occurs. So I guess the jury's still out on it, but I can see the complexities where you have sort of a distributed phase lock loop, as it were, where things are trying to synchronize in, and there's multiple sources distributed around with delays throughout the whole system. Go ahead, Dick.
Very fine, John. Was there another person who wanted to make a translation?
I was just going to say something, K2KEY.
Go ahead, Mel.
Funny, one time they had a program on, and basically they took you to a generating plant, and they basically were showing you something like the same thing as far as, you know, the sharing of the grid and how it was, you know, performed at the time some years ago. I guess it was right after the blackout. And I noticed what they did. They said that they called. He says they would call to the next station, the station over, and they would call for synchronization, Dick, over.
Yeah, John said that you would advance the phase in order to become a source. And I'm very skeptical of that, John. Let me show you why. Let's assume that I had two generators that are generating 60-cycle AC. And just for my simplicity, let's assume that each one generates 100 volts. And if they're exactly in phase with each other, each generating 100 volts, both of them act thoroughly in parallel, and no power flows between the two. Power only flows from those two generators to a load. These are two co-located generators. If I advanced generator number one compared to generator number two, on the upper half of the cycle, during the portion of the cycle that is rising, current will be flowing from generator number one, the advancing one, toward generator number two. That's what happens on the upward slope of the sine wave. On the downward slope of the sine wave, it's going to be the other way around. The direction of current flow is going to be flipping back and forth as I see it. If you've got two generators of equal voltage, slightly out of phase, you've got a whole lot of current flowing back and forth between the two generators, which ain't doing anything useful. On top of that, the way generators work, an AC generator, the one that is lagging in phase is really getting a push because of that cyclic current flow from the other one, which is trying to bring it into phase. So depending on the damping function between the two, you could have all kinds of bouncing action going on between your generators and twist up their shaft. And that has happened on some of these really superpower generators. The flexing of the shaft that is supplying power to the generator or to the load, from their source of rotary power into the actual generator itself, alternator, let's call it, the cyclic loading of power bouncing back and forth is flexing that shaft, and it can eventually create a fatigue failure. So in my opinion, if I was coming online in New York, I would make the phase between me and the grid 0 degrees offset. I would bring my voltage of my generator right up to the exact voltage of the grid. So now I am thoroughly synchronized with that grid. I've got the exact same voltage. I got the
repeater. Time out.
I've got the exact same voltage. I got the exact same phase. And now I close the switch between me and the grid. And in theory, nothing happens if I've synchronized everything in voltage, magnitude, and phase correctly. Then I start advancing the field winding of my alternator, so I'm starting to generate more voltage. Now the power starts flowing from me into the grid, from my generator into the grid. As I advance more and more the field current so that my alternator generates more and more voltage, eventually a phase shift occurs between me and Michigan because of the time delay, where in order to keep everything correct, now I have to start advancing phase in order for Michigan to become the greater load compared to me. So I think it's a very gentle process of in sync of amplitude and phase. When you first connect, slowly advance the amplitude, then slowly advance the phase as you become a greater source on that grid. That is my guess as to what's required. But that's just me sitting with pencil and paper making some guesses. I'm not sure. And it ain't an easy system. And a national grid has got some great advantages, and it's got some fantastic vulnerabilities if you haven't planned on all the possible failures ahead of time. That's a belief on my part. I'm again going to pass it back to John. But John, drag your feet in case there's someone else that's a little smarter on this and can tell us how Con Ed and LIPA really does it. The A2VDH to take it with a delay, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2KEY again.
Go ahead, Mel.
I have a book. I knew I had a book on this. It's called The Method of Generating Commercial Generation of Power and Electricity Metering. Okay? Very fancy up, and I just lost the fight. And I've just lost the fight. Oh, God, wait a minute. Here we go. Power plants. Between power plants, measurement is the lagging current, which is actually the alternating current, which in its half cycle reaches its maximum value a fraction of a cycle later than the maximum value of the voltage which produces it. The adjustment is on the commutator, mechanical adjustment of the commutator to compensate and bring both systems into sync. That's how it's done according to the book here. Over.
Now the word commutator has got me going here, because in the old days of DC generation, you had a real commutator. A modern day thing everyone calls generator, in my opinion, really is an alternator. The stator winding is what's connected to the actual high voltage transmission lines. Those are stator windings. The rotary winding is the magnetic field, and it's running on a slip ring, or the equivalent of a slip ring. So there is no real commutator in a modern day thing everyone calls generator, but it really is an alternator. That's my belief of what's going on here. But it sounds like, John, that these guys in Roosevelt, they worry about these things, and they want to have good, stable power. I've got my own generator in the backyard, by the way, when LIPA goes down. I bet you do also, John. W2VDH, K2LIW.
Fine business, Dick. Yeah, actually, my wife's been talking about getting the generator for ever since. Around here, we lose power pretty much if you go out and spit too hard. So if I suddenly drop out, I've heard some thunder in the background there. So if I suddenly disappear, that's why. There's a church down the street from me. Gets struck regularly, and it takes out the circuit breaker on the transformer that covers my part of the block. But anyway, so I guess there is no transmission line effects that are taken care of as far as, say, like shifting the six conductors to take every 500 miles or something like that to take care of the accumulated phase, because I guess, of course, power can be flowing both ways on these lines. Go ahead, Dick.
Well, when you say power flowing both ways, I mean, yes, maybe in the morning New York is a greater source than Michigan, and at nighttime maybe Michigan is a greater source than New York. So in the morning New York is the source, Michigan is the load, and at nighttime vice versa. So, yeah, power is flowing back and forth, but over an eight-hour period. It doesn't happen cycle to cycle. And I don't think they're doing physical switching of the actual conductors of that high-voltage transmission system on that national grid. All of the adjustment phase-wise is the exact advance or retarding of the armature of an alternator and the servo mechanism that makes all that come about. So locally, your generator has to be in phase with that grid, in my opinion. Otherwise, current is flowing back and forth uselessly, heating up lines and not doing anything as far as the load is concerned. So I think at the instant you connect, you are exactly in phase and exactly at the right amplitude. You connect and then you start advancing the amplitude, is my belief. And only when you become a very significant source of power compared to the very significant distant load, like Michigan in my example, then in order to make the timing take place, because of the number of milliseconds of time delay between New York and Michigan, when Michigan becomes the load, New York has to slowly advance the phase, in my opinion. But I'm not positive on that one. And it's complicated. I'm not sure we get the whole answer on this one, John. I think it's left for some further research. And fascinating stuff. But it is my belief that in time, we will eventually flip over to more and more high voltage DC for a number of reasons. It is more efficient. I mean, when you're driving 1,000 miles or 2,000 miles of high voltage wiring, there's a tremendous amount of capacitance to ground that you're driving. And that capacitance doesn't do anything useful. That's a lot of current flow, which you don't get anything back in return, so to speak. DC doesn't have that problem. Second of all, the peak voltage in DC is your peak power. In the case of AC, you don't go above a certain number of volts because you'll arc over your insulators. But your RMS is, 70% of your peak voltage. Your real power is 70% of the voltage that you're transmitting, and you can't go above that voltage without arcing the insulators. So the exact same amount of wire with the exact same insulation capability is going to give you greater power transmission capability with DC. And when it comes to phase advance, retard, phase angles, harmonic energy control, and so on, in other words, the reason why power factor is something very important at a major factory is that if I was running a whole lot of rotary machinery that's doing punching and drilling and whatever in my factory, and my rotary machinery is primarily an inductive load, which creates a phase lag, and therefore the useful power going into my machines versus the volt amperes coming out of the local transformer becomes more and more different as that power factor starts getting worse and worse. As such, that power company, LIPA, Con Ed, whatever, is going to force me to pay a premium if I don't correct power factor. And one of the ways of correcting power factor is to put in some great big capacitors in the right place. The capacitors create a capacitive load. My machinery creates an inductive load. When you get them balanced just right, it comes out with no reactance anymore, and the power factor goes to a unity, as opposed to something a hell of a lot worse. So now, for now, as far as the long line length between me and the local transformer is concerned, I've now got the 0 degrees of phase difference between the voltage and the current, and therefore I'm not wasting extra IR drop in that wiring with extra reactive current flowing. So that's somewhat what goes on with the power factor correction and why. Well, that's one kind of correction. If I'm running a whole lot of computers and a great big factory that's doing word processing, and that did take place in Manhattan a decade or so ago, and these computers all have very simple voltage rectifiers on the 110-volt line charging capacitors so that all the peaks of the voltage are being chopped away and the harmonic power on the line is now increasing. That's another case where I think Con Ed will charge you a premium if you're doing that, and they want you to stop doing it. And so there's a power, what is that now called? I can't even think of the name of the machine that they add to a factory in order, a conditioner. You might be forced to add a conditioner to correct the fact that you're creating harmonic power. In other words, it's not a pure sine wave on that line anymore. The peaks are being chopped off, and the odd harmonics are being increased because of what's happening in the rectifiers of your 1,000 computers that you're running in this factory. And they're going to force you to add a conditioner to stop that from happening. I guess it was Glenn, KC2QCQ, who was KC2QQ, he knew the guy, I mean, KC2QCQ, I think it is. He has done quite a bit of work with electronic circuits that act as conditioners to correct these conditions. Any with any further questions or comments on all of the above, we're slowly getting smarter on this subject. K2RL in the TechNet. Okay. I'm sure you didn't get the answer you're looking for, John, because we don't know yet. But at least we know a little more of the variables involved. And as you find out more about this, John, please come back and let us know what you find out. You were saying that you think that you become the source by advancing the phase. Until you advance the voltage first and then advance the phase later, I think that's the order in which it has to happen. Yeah, I think. I wonder if it made a little bit of sense to you, John. W2VDH, KQLIW.
Okay, fine, business stick. Tell you what, I'll do some digging in on it, but I remember from my, I think it was at Newtown High School, I remember we had an electrical lab there, and I remember saying that after synchronization, you advance the phase. But I'll dig into it, and as I said, I'll get back to you. Okay, I'm going to kick it back to you, Dick, so I know you have there's other questions. So, again, thanks for the information on it.
Yeah, fascinating question you asked there, John, and please come back to us with whatever you find. I think I've gone down the list of people who said they had a question. Let me throw it open to the group and see if I skipped anyone by mistake. If so, speak now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is K2KEY. I've been reading this book, just some other parts, and some interesting things about what you just said, Dick.
N2RSO with suit-to-suit info.
N2RSO, very good. Bernie, I think that is.
Hey.
With suit-to-suit info. And let's see, who was it that asked that earlier? I think it was Joe. Let's go to Mel first and then Bernie in that order. Mel, go right ahead. What have you found?
Reading this book, and it tells you how something about it, and they tell you about this alternator, the adjustment of the alternator system.
the theory behind the inductive load adjustment of inductive load and or power factor adjustment was presented by Schallenberger back in 1890 when he discovered the theory that in order to have correct registration with very low power factor, the potential coil flux must lag the current coil flux exactly at 90 degrees. So then he goes on, it is a mechanical adjustment still. In modern power plants, it is still done mechanically, Dick. And this is what it boils down to, the last sentence. And then, how old is this book? I don't know. Let's see. This book, 1983, over.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find quite a bit has happened since 1983. But, we'll soon find out. We'll find out more about that. I called him Bernie, but it's Frank. Hey, Frank, in 2RSO, go right ahead with your question.
Hey, good evening, Dick. Now, it's not a question, just the earlier question that someone had about the frequency used for the suit-to-suit communication. And I found an interesting website. They show the frequency is 279 megacycles, AM, and that's EVA suit to EVA suit and orbiter to EVA suit. There's another frequency, 296.8, which is the air-to-ground and another orbiter to EVA suit. The website, I emailed you a copy of the URL. If you want to follow up. But it's, the website is called Radio Online, Your Guide to Monitoring the Space Shuttle. And a lot of interesting things here. If somebody wants to look it up, rather than giving you the URL over the air, I think you can just Google Radios Online and find it very easily. K2RIW and 2RSO.
Very fine, Frank. So I think if I understand you correctly, a person who Googles the words radios online, he will find this. And I see that according to QRZ, you're a member of quite a number of radio clubs. My goodness. Where do you get the time for all that, Frank? So to repeat, do you believe a person who just simply Googles radios online and suit-to-suit, maybe radios online plus suit-to-suit, you know, with a plus sign, and you can use a Boolean LUT with Google. There's a whole procedure by which you can find information a lot faster once you get skilled with Google. Back to you, Frank. N2RSO, K2RAW.
K2RAW.
Eric recognized, but Frank first.
Actually, I'm on Google right now. I looked up NASA space suit radio frequency, and the first entry it brought me to was how to monitor the space shuttle, and the URL is kind of convoluted. It's home.flash.net/ that crazy little wiggly sign. I'm not sure what that's called, and it's AV8TOR/radios/shuttle. I'm sure you'll find it a lot easier by Googling. Back to net and to RSO.
Yeah, that's the right way to do it. Eric, you've got it.
Yeah, you can Google spacesuit to shuttle radio frequency, and it'll bring you to spacetoday.org, and they give you spacewalk communications, 259.7, 269.8, shuttle spacesuit, 279, spacesuit to shuttle, and 279 spacesuit to spacesuit. Launcher landing is 296.8, which is shuttle to ground primary UHF, and 259.7, which is shuttle to ground backup UHF. But there's a lot of different sites that all have this. So, you know, simple as spacesuit to shuttle radio frequency. That will get you there. K2RW, K2J.
Sounds good. To your knowledge, Eric, I vaguely remember in the past people talking about ground reception of the space suit. I haven't heard the guys claiming that recently, but I think in the past a number of serious amateur radio operators have listened to the suit. What do you think? Over to you, Eric.
I think that's pretty possible. I know a bunch of people that were doing that about 10 years ago, but they made the recordings of the direct transmission, so I don't see why not.
Another fun thing to do. An amazing number of amateurs have now been listening to the main carrier of some of the space probes that are on the way to Mars and Moon and whatever, and to listen to a weak signal in the noise that's coming from a NASA spacecraft that's 100 million miles away is a real good trick. Amateurs have also bounced a signal off of Venus with a little help of somebody else's hardware. So it can be done with modern-day techniques. To my knowledge now, mankind has bounced signals off of the Sun, Venus, Moon, Mars. I'm not sure whether or not they bounce signals off of Jupiter, but if someone told me they had, I wouldn't be a bit surprised. In the case of Venus, the bouncing of signals off Venus have allowed them to do some pretty accurate mapping of what the soil looks like on Venus, even though it's got some very thick clouds, and your ability to look optically through those clouds with a orbiting spacecraft and see what the ground looks like is very difficult, if not impossible. Venus has got some really ridiculous atmosphere. I think their atmosphere, not only is it super hot, but I think it's got something like the pressure of 90 atmospheres. It's got a very high pressure, very cloudy, acidic, hot atmosphere. Other than that, it's a nice place to go. You send a spacecraft there, and it's got to have some local cooling that's going to keep your spacecraft alive for, say, 20 minutes or so when you get on the ground, and after that, normal solid-state circuitry can't tolerate numbers like, I think the number is like 800 degrees Fahrenheit on the surface of Venus. Not a pleasant place to go. Mars is too cold, and the atmosphere is too sparse. Venus is too hot, and the atmosphere is too dense. We live in the Goldilocks planet, and we take that for granted. Is there someone else who signed in that we haven't gotten to? Give me your call letters right now. Or if you got a further question or comment on all of the above, give me your call letters. K2RIW, the TechNet. Okay. We may have run out of guest...
to put a space in for Kent.
Kent, I think, is on the way back from the Central States VHF Society. I had a few conversations with him today. He was at Fermilab. They were escorting him through the muon detector. And so at Fermilab, which is close in Chicago to where the Central States VHF Society held their meeting this weekend, and he was one of the major presenters of some of the awards as well as one of the major speakers on the current state-of-the-art of computer modeling of antennas. Kent publishes articles in CQ magazine as well as a number of British magazines, as well as being the publisher for the North Texas Microwave Society. Their magazine, I think it's called Pulse. No, that's the IEEE magazine. All of a sudden I've forgotten the name of it. But he's a busy guy. And to my knowledge, he's in his vehicle driving home right now. We'll give a great big long delay in case someone out of area wants to sign into this TechNet. I've been hearing tell that the people in places like Las Vegas and California as well as Texas sometimes listen to this TechNet. K2R, you're standing by.
This is W7HTL, Phil in Las Vegas. Yes.
Phil recognized W7HTL. Stand by. I'll see if there's anyone else.
Dick at 2EL. Put me at the end of the list, Dick.
Rich, we got. Anyone else?
KC2OLA.
OLA recognized. Anyone else?
K2KIF.
Okay, let's go to Phil. to how long you've been listening out there to this particular TechNet and Phil, and how did you find out that it existed? Whiskey 7, Hotel Tango Lima, K2 Real Indian Woman. My name is Dick.
Hey, Dick, real good. Yeah, I've been listening for several months at least, and there's been quite a few people here in town that... Well, I just had a question. They made a statement today that they took supplies up to the space shuttle, and the supplies weighed 2.5 tons. They took 2.5 tons of supplies to the space station. What does it really weigh out there? Is it totally weightless, or is there some weight to it? That's my question. Over.
Very fine, Phil. Yeah, they may have changed the name, but the Soviet supply ships used to be called Progress, and they're bringing up 5,000 pounds of supplies. And those 5,000 pounds consists of water, food, and other consumables, as well as hardware. And the word weight and the word mass are words that are frequently misunderstood. Everything in the world has mass. Only when there is a local acceleration or a local gravity do you sense what you and I call weight. Let's assume I weigh 200 pounds. I stand on my scale in my bathroom, and if the scale is accurate, it reads 200 pounds. If I take my scale and me in the space shuttle and I put me in orbit, which is called microgravity or weightlessness, and I stand on that scale, I put that scale on the floor of the space shuttle or the International Space Station, and I stand on it, it will read zero because I am being accelerated. By that I mean when you're in the vicinity of the Earth, you fall 32 feet per second, so to speak. In the first 1 second that you jump off your tower, you're going to fall 16 feet, but at the end of that second, you'll be moving 32 feet per second. You'll be continuously accelerating toward the Earth because of gravity. When you're in orbit on the space shuttle or the International Space Station, you're falling at the same rate, but you're moving ahead 17,500 miles an hour, and you're falling around the Earth. When I jump off my tower, if I was foolish enough to do that, during the time that I'm in the air, if I don't count wind resistance, in between the top of the tower where I jump and until I strike the ground, I am weightless. And when you're in orbit, you're continuously falling in that manner, just that you're moving ahead so fast that the place where you fall is no longer a straight down. It's a curved path, and that curvature matches the curvature of the Earth, if you know what I mean. That's one way of looking at it. So now, in space, you cannot weigh an object. But in space, I can find out if an object has mass. On the Earth, I can put my object, I can put my object on the end of a spring, I can deflect the spring a little bit, and watch the object bob up and down. If I know the spring constant, and I know the amount of weight that I have put on the end of the spring, by measuring the period of its motion, a little bit of a calculation, I can figure out how heavy is that object. When I put something in space where it is weightless, or it has microgravity, as they say, I can't weigh it with a scale anymore, but I can use that exact same spring. I can put that mass that I don't know about on the end of the spring, deflect the spring, measure the period of its motion. So everything has mass. You can't make the mass disappear. That really means what that spring is doing on each half cycle, it's accelerating it forward and then decelerating it and reversing the process. That's what the spring is doing. It really is measuring the mass of your object. Because as the object gets heavier and heavier, the spring will move back and forth the same amount, but it will do it more slowly. It's the space equivalent of a pendulum. You know what a grandfather clock looks like. Well, the grandfather clock swings back and forth a pendulum because there's a mass on the end of a rod, and gravity is restoring it back to zero, very similar to what happens when your child is on a swing. But you can't do that in space. But you can still use a spring. And I can't remember the guy's name right now. It starts with an H. The guy who made a very accurate clock in the 1800s. And it takes accurate clocks in order to be able to do good navigating on ships. and his clock didn't use pendulums, it used springs. The old-fashioned gold watch that people used to wear in their pocket, it uses a weight that swings back and forth with a spring. So the 5,000 pounds they're bringing up, they have to do that every couple of weeks. That gives you a little bit of an idea of how difficult it's going to be to send a man to Mars, because that supply ship is a very long distance on the way to Mars. A human being consumes a lot of stuff, and the Earth recycles it all for us. And boy, we forget about that very, very rapidly. I wonder if some of that made some sense, Phil. And once again, how did you find out a couple of weeks ago? I think you said for a few weeks you've been listening to the TechNet. How did you find out it existed? W7, Hotel Tango Lima. In Henderson, Nevada, KQRIW, in Huntington, Long Island.
Yeah, K2RIW, W7HTL returning. Yeah, it all makes sense. I understand what you're saying. And I appreciate you explaining it to me there. Well, we've been listening several months, and it started, we have a repeater here in town up on a mountain that has IRLP connection, and I don't specifically allow it to be any hooked up to any one system in it on a continuous basis. It's only intermittently. We move it around and listen to different groups and conversations. Reflector, this reflector 9126 is one we ran across, and then we ran across you and the TechNet there. So it's really interesting, and there's quite a few people listening here. Over.
Very fine, Phil, and thanks for checking in. We'll have to give enough delay so that the people out of the area get a chance to check in. We'll have to do that a little more often. Sometimes we're a little fast on the switch here in New York. These New Yorkers are very quick on the push-to-talk switch. The next person who signed in was Michael, KC2OLA. What would you like to tell us or ask, Mike? You've got it. I'm pretty sure I heard KC2OLA sign in. The next person who signed in was K2KIS. Tell us your name, sir, and your question or comment.
I think you forgot me, Dick, and 2EO.
No, you're after those guys.
Yeah, correction, it's K2KIF. That's Kilo India Frank. And we're just checking in at sitting K2KIF.
Okay. Rich, N2EO, go right ahead.
Okay, Dick, good evening, N2EO. Dick, my question is on what's termed ROHS, R-O-H-S. I forget what the acronym stands for, but it has to do with the elimination of lead in solder and lead in electronics in general. I was talking to somebody on a 440 repeater today, and he commented, and I don't know if it's just what he read or the way he read it, but he made it sound like they're pulling all the lead, what we know as 6040 lead tin solder from the shelves. That's the way it sounded. What is the story on ROHS? What I'm wondering, if they are eventually going to do away with leaded solder, you know, I do a lot of building, a lot of repair work, a lot of restoration on old equipment. What happens when you mix the new lead-free solder with the old solder? Say, for instance, on some of these radios I restore from the 1950s and 60s, it's not like desoldering clean from a VC board. You've got terminal strips where you might remove a part by cutting a lead and tacking on a new resistor, a new capacitor, or whatever. Has anybody thought of what happens when you mix the new solders with the old solder? Do they mix? And after this gentleman told me what he told me, I went online and ordered two extra pound spools of Kester 6040 solder from Antique Electronic Supply in Tempe, Arizona this evening. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, TechNet, Weimark, and 2EO.
Okay, Rojas is written down as R-O-H-S. People pronounce it Rojas. It stands for Removal of Hazardous Substances. Removal of Hazardous Substances. And somebody has declared lead the hazardous substance. When it's used for sealing a can, a food tin, lead, after a long period of time, is hazardous. It slowly leaches into the food, and in the case of one of those expeditions in the 1800s that went to a Arctic area, the food poisoning did give them a lot of trouble. There are people who worried about the parts per million or parts per billion of lead that you get from your copper water pipes in your house because they were soldered with old-fashioned lead tin solder. And so lots of people believe if we eliminate lead from our electronics and eliminate it from our water pipes, that life will be better. That sounds good. But the substitute for lead has not really been found from my point of view. The leadless solders with their more exotic fluxes are much more troublesome. They run at a slightly higher temperature, and they're much more difficult to get a good solder joint without it being a cold joint. The wetting action of non-leaded solder is really troublesome. So the people who have to perfect the process of doing flow soldering of boards when they're done leadlessly have got to work a lot harder, and they get more failures. There are a number of military programs that have specifically said, Department of Defense programs, where they have specifically said, you will not use leadless solder on this program in this particular area. They have discovered that under certain conditions, the lead from solder grows tin whiskers, and those tin whiskers eventually make short circuits within your integrated circuit. So there are certain critical areas where lead-free solder is very troublesome. So although there are some super enthusiastic people trying to eliminate the lead from our environment and trying to eliminate lead-bearing solder, I think for a good fraction of your and my lifetime is my prediction, there will be available with greater difficulty, just like what has happened with Freon 12, with greater and greater difficulty, you still will be able to get a hold of a leaded solder. I prefer leaded solder because it's a lot easier to use. I think I have used lead-free solder for a short period of time. Let me drop. And it's very difficult to use. To my knowledge, lead-free solder and leaded solder do mix. I don't think there's a problem there. In other words, if you're forced to use lead-free solder on top of a joint previously used 6040 solder, I think there's no real problem there. But let me find out if other people on this net are smarter than me on that particular subject. How compatible are the new and old solders, if you happen to know? Give me a call, let us right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
A2KEY, I had that trouble today.
AC2QIQ with a comment.
Mel and Glenn, in that order, is anyone else? Okay, Mel first. Mel, what problem did you have? Buying the solder, mixing them together? K2KEY, go right ahead.
Hey, all of a sudden I get a complaint today. There's something dripping under the sink. I hear water dripping. So I open the closet door, and sure enough, there's water dripping. And this is the sink drain comes together with another drain that's for the dishwasher, and then joins up in the main drain with another one that comes from the second sink. It's a whole contraption of pipes that were put together there, and it was one of my good friends many years ago that was a plumber that came up with he did it. He said, let me do this for you. Okay, let me do it for you. Well, P.S., one of the joints started to leak. So I went ahead and I got under there, don't ask and all, and I laid out some material, the metal and everything, so I can do some brazing under there without setting the house on fire.
And the stuff I use, it says big letters, this is what you got to use now. Going to plumbing supply, they give you a container, a nice container of flux, and they give you this solder, which says no lead in big letters, 95% tin, 5% antimony. And I bought this, you know, to do general copper soldering of the copper pipes when I put them together. So I use this. Now the old solder on there was put on 30 years some ago. That was most likely had lead in it, I'm sure, 30 years or more ago. And I found no problem whatsoever using this new solder, Dick. If you use the flux with it, it seems that flux, there's something in that flux that makes it wet real well, over.
Hey, dude. Okay. Glenn's going to give us some words, and then Eric in that order. Glad to hear that that it did work. Glenn first, KC2QIQ, go ahead.
Yeah, good evening. Just a couple of quick comments about the about leaded solder in the United States. There's no restriction on products produced in the United States, electronic products, for leaded solder. So it's really the international, anything going to be sold in the EC, and it's spreading kind of around the world. But right now there is no directive here in the United States. The downside is, as far as getting a hold of the leaded solder, is that you're finding less and less manufacturers, especially the commercial manufacturers, are producing or using the lead solder. So it's becoming a little bit harder to find, but it should still be available. And like you're saying, there's still some active military programs that they're definitely using the leaded solder on. As far as the usage of the lead-free solder on older equipment, the key thing is, yes, they will mix, but the downside is you have to operate the melting temperature of lead-free solder is much higher than the leaded solders. So what you're going to have to do is get soldering irons that a lot of them will adjust to those temperatures, but you have to watch your tips a lot more carefully. And also, any of the electronic components that you're soldering to, be very, very careful or look at the ratings, the solder temperature ratings of the components, because you could damage them with the higher temperatures. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, thank you, Glenn. Good information. Eric, you do a lot of soldering in your business. I'll bet you've used some lead-free solder. You use the higher temperature irons. You might know how much extra temperature. In the case of some integrated circuits where you have to solder them kind of fast, make sure you don't create any damage with the new higher temperature lead-free solder. My guess is you got to be a lot more careful or buy special integrated circuits. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2J. Well, I bottle lead-free soldering just for the heck of it, but, you know, I like using the leaded solder better. It's the lower temperature. The lead-free solder is, you really got about 280, 300 degrees Celsius to be in the right range. And, you know, it's all surface mount stuff, so I air blast the stuff as opposed to using iron. I will say this, since in the past few years, the development of different types of flux, you know, the traditional rosin flux, which is kind of messy by today's standards, is there are a number of different water-soluble fluxes that are great. And so instead of having to use, defluxing solvent at the end of your project, or even commercially, they use the water-soluble solvents, and you basically wash it off. You wind up with a very beautiful open board. I mix solders all the time, but you can tell where you mix it. It depends, really, if you're going to mix them, you got to make sure that there's no dirt, and it's got to be really clean for it to make a nice joint there. But I'm only looking at it from a little tiny point of view, and today's, most of today's surface mount components, they're designed to take 6 to 7 seconds of those temperatures. So the concept is with flow soldering or baking, basically what they'll do, put a drop of glue underneath each component and glue it to the board, and you'll on a solder paste, by the way, That's my favorite way of working on it. So.